Here we go. It's the 1st of August, and I've got both our boys born in August, 3 years and only 5 days apart, so coming up on 37 and 40, that'll dig you for the boys. But this is our 8th class in the book of Daniel. We had an extremely busy week. Last week in chapter 7, I truly feel like I need to apologize, and yet there wasn't anything I could do about it. That's a lot of material, and I just couldn't think of a good way to try to break it and wait a week and come back. There really wasn't time in the overall scheme of our schedule anyway. And so you were just, you know, drinking at that proverbial fire hose last week. So what we saw is what you see on the screen. In Daniel chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar has a terrifying dream, and beyond all conceivable doubt, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome are what the respective parts of that statue represent. And, of course, except for those who are caught up in the mythology of premillennialism, which, by the way, is a fading mistake. Those people, Seventh-day Adventists, the Jehovah's Witnesses, and most especially the Hal Lindsey, you know, with his late great Planet Earth and all that in the 80s, and then the whole series left behind, the enormous numbers of millions of dollars that they made on that, and it all failed. It fails constantly. It fails regularly. It fails spectacularly. And I think we're actually witnessing the decline of two things in our generation, both of which we can really rejoice in. Roman Catholicism is a shadow of its horrifying and abysmal self. And we've watched that happen in the course of our generation, really like never before. It's just astonishing how much influence and power that they have lost, and aren't we grateful for it? But we're also seeing the decline of premillennialism. It's just not the force to be reckoned with that it used to be. We should rejoice and be glad for that as well, for it has deceived and misled enormous numbers of people. But here, Daniel was, you know, the foundation for all of those errors. And we're going to be looking now in these chapters, 7 and following, to see such minute detail. And when you get it straight, you know, it's really pretty encouraging. It's powerful to see that God meant what he said what he meant. And you can actually see that he's foretelling the future. You can see where the fulfillments were since we live on this side. And so, in Daniel chapter 2, no problem for Bible students. This is what it represents. In chapter 7 last week, we have a lion with wings, a bear that's raised up somehow on one side with three ribs in its mouth. We have a four-headed leopard that has the four wings of a bird. And then this monstrous beast all coming up out of the sea, which, by the way, Revelation 17:15 identifies as being the peoples or the Gentile. And other places in the Old Testament as well. And so these represent physical, carnal, material nations, one after the other, and they're the exact same four nations that Nebuchadnezzar saw in his dream. It's just that Daniel now is seeing them in his. Now, as we come to chapter 8 this evening, we are not going to be talking about Babylon at all. We will be talking about Medo-Persia, this time under the figure of a ram. And then we will be talking about Greece under the figure of a goat. And then we will not be talking about Rome. And so, brother, what I think we're actually seeing is that this is really pretty straightforward, that statue. There's four component parts, and the only complexity you get is that the legs and the feet, you know, have an amalgamation there at the end. Since Rome was unable to, you know, cohese, then eventually it was weakened and it would fall. Largely because of the influence, as Jesus foretold, of the church. There's more detail, if you will. There's more parts that are involved in chapter 7. I counted 60 of them. It's a sharpening, I think, clarity about these same four kingdoms. And now we have a whole chapter that's devoted only to two of those. The one that's going to be taking over at the end of Daniel's life as he's in Babylonian captivity. The one that is close upon him. And then the one that will follow, but not the one that's so far out. It's more detail. Wait till we get into succeeding chapters. And it's more and more detail. beyond all doubt, it's the same thing. We're talking about these four kingdoms and the coming of an eternal kingdom that's going to be taking place, going to be founded, instituted, you know, in the days of those Roman kings. So that's where we're headed tonight. We're going to talk about Medo-Persia and Greece. There is absolutely not even a question anymore because they're named in the chapter. So you could almost just stop right here and say, well, the chapter's about Medo-Persia and Greece. Dates can be found in history, you know, and so case closed. But there's the detail. It is the detail that helps us to have such a great faith. As you've heard me say so very many times, and particularly recently I've been studying miracles, there's no religion in the history of mankind that even pretends to be able to either work the miracles, and especially among them, to foretell the future, than this one of which we are a part. It's not head and shoulders above any other claim to being a religion that comes from God. It's out there in the stratosphere somewhere. You need a spaceship to get up, you know, to the top of the superiority, the grandness, the magnificence, you know, and the difference that there is in Christianity over every religion that there's ever been. And as you look at these religions, these nations, we talk about, you know, how each one got successively bigger, you know, and all the rest of that, but which one's the biggest? The rock that's cut out without hands and destroys the other four there in Daniel chapter 2 fills the whole world. There's just nothing like it in chapter 4. It fills the whole world in another dream of Nebuchadnezzar's. And so there's never been anything that's remotely like it. You can't begin to compare anything else to it. So it is, you know, with excitement, with confidence, with faith, that we live our daily lives and look forward to meeting the Creator of the universe who has control, who rules in the kingdoms of men. So now, as we come to Daniel chapter 8, let's get the setting. First read 8 verses 1 and 2. In the third year of the reign of Belshazzar, I don't know how to pronounce it, the king, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, subsequent to the one which appeared to me previously. Now, the third year of the reign of Belshazzar is thought to be 550 B.C. So you can write that down. In Daniel 8 verses 1 and 2, know this, though, remember, put it in the margin. Chapter 1, verse 1 through chapter 2, verse 3 was in what language? Hebrew. And that switched to chapter 2, verse 4 through the last verse in chapter 7 to Aramaic. So what have we got in chapter 8 and verse 1? Back to the Hebrew, which apparently has to do with also the nature of the material. We're going to be turning now more to the holy people, to how these other nations, these Gentile nations, these carnal nations, these ungodly nations, are impacting the holy people, the saints of chapter 7, the Jews who will be living throughout all of those centuries and throughout all of those nations. So in chapters 8 through 12, this is spoken in Hebrew, and as I suggested, about 550 B.C. Now, as you read then next, it says in verse 2, I looked in the vision, it came about while I was looking that I was in the citadel of Susa, which is in the province of Elam, and I looked in the vision, and I myself was beside the Ulai Canal. Now, this region, I put the map up for you there, of Elam is very well marked on this particular map. And you see Susa right here, that little circle. Some translations have Shushan. It depends on who you're reading down through the ages. Some say Shushan, some say Susan, as a matter of fact. And about three or four different ways, depending again on the languages, people reference the, you know, a nation that's not their own. But the point is that Susa then, or Shushan, however you might have it in your translation, is the capital now, and is in today what would barely be within modern Iran. The border comes down like this, and so it's just, you know, some few miles inside what is modern-day Iran. Here's our Tigris River, here's the Euphrates River, you're looking at the Persian Gulf, and we're going to be talking about Medo-Persia tonight. And so this is the start of our Fertile Crescent, which is going to go all the way down, you know, far out over there to Israel. And then we have this group of people that you can see. Assyria was largely to the north. There's Nineveh, their capital. But as Daniel's writing, what about them? They're gone. Who took over? Well, there's Babylon, you know, and their capital was right here on the Euphrates River. And Babylon is about to be no more. So we're coming into the Medes and the Persians, a combined nation that's going to be taking over here, and their capital is right there in Susa. So just inside what would be modern-day Iran, and their kingdom is going to be larger than Babylon was. This is an aerial view of the palace at Susa. This is, as you can see, a fairly extensive archaeological site. This tower that you see right here, and building that goes with it, is traditionally ascribed as the tomb of David. As far as I can tell, there's absolutely no reason to believe that other than just the word of mouth. Now, often of which I think has been started by a tour guide in cahoots with a taxi driver. I'm sure you most do. You come up sometimes with stuff. Yeah, no justification for it at all. Now, I've heard stories that John, at least two places where you could go look at the skull of John the Baptist. Think about that one for a while. So there's no reason to believe that, but then, you know, maybe in the deepest, darkest recesses of time, you know, Daniel might have been buried somewhere around there. I mean, you know, it's remotely possible. But at this point, we don't have any real archaeological reason to think so. Still, it's an extensive city. You can see to this day that you've got this river coming along through here. There are actually three rivers, though people kind of argue about it, and I think Daniel decides for us that there was a canal that was also involved, the Euline Canal. And as a matter of fact, there were great canal builders. All the people occupied this area because you had these two main rivers, the Tigris and Euphrates, and got crisscrossed with canals trying to keep all the intervening lands as fertile as possible. So this is, you know, modern Susa as viewed from above. From the Encyclopedia Britannica this time, I grabbed this quote, quote, Susa is one of the oldest cities on Earth. Excavations have uncovered evidence of a continual habitation dating back to 4,200 B.C. That's a long while ago. Susa was a principal city of the Elamites, Persian, and Parthian empires, the capital of the Elamites, and was originally known to Elamites as Susan or Susun. The Greek name for the city was Susa, and the Hebrew is Shushan, and this became in English Susa. All of that is to say that this particular excavation, of course, gives you, you know, some insight also into the growth of dirt. Dirt grows. Amazing stuff. Once I got to get a little test in his backyard, he has some cinder blocks in a pit, and then he just did nothing with it for a handful of years. And every year, grass would grow on the bottom, then the grass would die, and when the grass dies, what does it become? Dirt. Until it just kept growing up, and it's getting flush with the ground outside. He was growing dirt right before his very eyes. Look how much dirt grew here. Down to these foundations down here, but over the centuries, all of that had been buried over. Century after century after century of growth and cycles of nature dying off, and they had to dig all that way down just to get, you know, to the old foundation wall. So Susa, or Shushan, has yielded some particularly interesting archaeological artifacts. Here is one, which is a winged lion with a ram's head and a griffin's hind legs, enameled tile frieze from the palace of Darius I at Susa in lieu of Paris. Now that's what they found. And you can see originally it would have been really quite beautiful, very colorful, you know, kind of an outlandish animal. But what did you notice? It is a what? A lion that has wings, which in Daniel's book represented what? Babylon. And then last week, chapter 7, and now we've got a ram's head that is on this body. And tonight we're going to see a ram representing Medo-Persia, as a matter of fact. Now, again, it's about the third time I think in this class I've said this. I don't know what to make out of that. It's kind of chicken and the egg sort of a thing where you wonder if God led Daniel seeing these motifs to, you know, see those motifs in vision as well, or even the possibility, how important, how influential, how persuasive, how much power has Daniel wielded in the last 70 years? Enormous amounts. Did he catch Nebuchadnezzar's fancy? Time and again, what was Nebuchadnezzar forced to do in the presence of Daniel? Praise the God of Daniel. Hananiah, Mishael. Hananiah, Mishael, and Ezra. Okay. These guys stood out from everybody else. Miracles are being performed by and around them. Death-defying things, lions and fiery furnaces, you know, all that. And so these people had a reputation. And so you wonder where these motifs come from, which side or the other, but as God uses them, it wouldn't matter. God picked this motif, and it represents well each of these various nations that we've been talking about. Now, let's be reading chapter 8, verses 3 through 7. Then I lifted my gaze and I looked, and behold, a ram, which had two horns, which is typical, of course, was standing in front of the canal. Now, the two horns were long, but one was longer than the other, with the longer one coming up last. I saw the ram budding westward, northward, and southward, and no other beasts could stand before him. Nor was there anyone to rescue from his power. But he did as he pleased, and he magnified himself. While I was observing, behold, a male goat was coming from the west over the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground, and the goat, a conspicuous horn between his eyes, had a conspicuous horn. He came up to the ram that had the two horns, which I had seen standing in front of the canal, and rushed at him in his mighty wrath. And I saw him, come beside the ram, and he was enraged at him, and he struck the ram and shattered his two horns, and the ram had no strength to withstand him. So he hurled him to the ground and trampled on him, and there was none to rescue the ram from his power. So Daniel thought something like this. All the artists portray it as being oversized. It does sound like likely that was the case, you know, but perhaps not. One of them isn't even touching the ground. They have features that are going to be very unusual as this vision develops. And so at least initially, we have these two animals that look very like normal animals, say one of them has a horn that's bigger than the other. And that's not unusual, you know, or impossible, not even all that rare in nature anyhow. So here he sees it. I don't know who this artist was. It looks like an older illustration here. But, you know, he did a good job, I think, of just portraying the wonder of it all in the body of Daniel right there. And you'd be doing the same thing. You know, that suddenly comes this apparition. What is that? What does that mean? What's going to happen next? What's going to happen next is in verses 8 and 9. Then the male goat magnified himself exceedingly, but as soon as he was mighty, the large horn was broken, and in its place there came up four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of heaven. Out of one of them came forth a rather small horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the beautiful land. And it grew up. Now let's stop right there. Okay, so we got something like this. There was one notable horn. That horn, you know, now is broken off, and four horns sprout out of it. So now Daniel continues looking at this vision. Well, I'm conquering, but, you know, or the conquered, rather, now sprouts these four horns. And at this point in time, I have no doubt, you know, Daniel says so at the end of the chapter, he's just really wondering, what is going on? And then another horn grows up. And it starts off as just a little thing, but it's going to get prodigious, to say the least. So we go to verse 10. It grew up to the host of heaven and caused some of the host and some of the stars to fall to the earth. And it trampled them down. It even magnified itself to be equal with the commander of the host. And it removed the regular sacrifice from him, and the place of his sanctuary was thrown down. And on account of transgression, the host will be given over to the horn along with the regular sacrifice. And it will fling truth to the ground, and perform its will and prosper. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to that particular one who was speaking, "How long will the vision about the regular sacrifice apply while the transgression causes horror so as to allow both the holy place and the host to be trampled?" And he said to me, "For 2,300 evenings and mornings, then the holy place will be properly restored." Now, if you have, you know, real fine lead in your pencil or pen there, "properly restored" in other translations has been translated "vindicated" and also "cleansed." So the word has an array, you know, of ideas. It can be restored, it can be vindicated, it can be cleansed. But in this vision, we have these pieces to the puzzle that are really quite readily identifiable. So we're going to talk about this for quite a bit of time right now, because you're going to see right there in verses 10 through 14, and particularly in 13 and 14, that is the heart. That's the core. That's what Daniel is talking about in the whole chapter. That's what the entire vision is really pointing at. So we got these component parts, and we've got two nations, and we've got horns, and we've got a lot of stuff going on. But you're going to see, then I'm going to read it again, 13 and 14 is the nubbin. So in 13, I heard a holy one speaking. Another holy one said to that particular one who was speaking, "How long will the vision about the regular sacrifice apply while the transgression causes horror so as to allow both the holy place and the host to be trampled?" And he said to me, "For 2,300 evenings and mornings, then the holy place will be properly restored." Now please note that in 11, 12, and 13, three consecutive verses, we get this phrase, "the regular sacrifice." That regular sacrifice, whatever that is really important. It is as important as seeing that because they've transgressed, because of transgression, then the holy people and the host are going to be trampled. Now that host is not the host of stars in heaven. It's not the host of heavenly beings. Host just means extremely numerous and innumerable. But the host is going to get trampled here. The host is going to suffer. The host has transgressed, and that group of people, whoever they may be, then are going to be cast down. So the regular sacrifice, though, mentioned in 11, 12, and 13, becomes the name of the whole vision in verse 13. So for a third time, read verse 13. "Heard a holy one speaking. Another holy one said to that particular one who was speaking, 'How long will the vision of the regular sacrifice apply?'" He just gave you a name for the whole vision. It's the vision of what? The regular sacrifice. It's the vision of the regular sacrifice. And what's going to happen to that regular sacrifice? Well, it's going to be removed in verse 11. "On account of transgression, the host will be given over along with the regular sacrifice." So it's given over as well as removed. And here in 13, the holy place and the host are going to be trampled at the same time that this holy, regular sacrifice, which is the name of the vision, you know, is ceasing. Now, again though, look at verse 14 now. The answer is, to the how long question, 2300 evenings and mornings. Then the holy place will be properly restored, slash vindicated, slash cleansed. Now note, if you'll skip ahead to verse 26, right at the end of the chapter now, the vision of the evenings and mornings, which has been told, is true. But keep the vision secret, for it pertains to many days. Now they've added italics in the future, and clearly that's what he's talking about. Daniel's not going to live to see it. This is in the distant future. But look there at 14 and 26. So now when you compare the evenings and the mornings, that is a second name for the vision. It is called the vision of the regular sacrifice. And it is called the vision of the evenings and mornings. And the vision of the evenings and mornings is about 2,300 days when the regular sacrifice has been removed. Brethren, it's really not all that hard to figure out what this means. If you're a premillennialist, a Seventh-day Adventist, you know, those kind of folks, they have terrible problems with it. But if you know a little bit about history and you trust Daniel to mean what he says, he certainly proved himself, as has everybody else in the book so far, then really, you know, I don't think it's really all that hard. We have a vision of a regular sacrifice, and we have a vision of evenings and mornings. How long will the regular sacrifice not be regular, not be sacrificed? How long will it cease and be removed? 2,300 evenings and mornings. Now, immediately, brethren, you see that term, and what do you think because of Genesis? You think days. So you say 2,300 days. Now, 2,300 days is 6 years and 4 months. 6 years, four. Okay? 2,300 evenings and mornings, if you take an evening and a morning to represent a single day, is 6 years and 4 months. So right in the margin of my Bible here, you know, I've written 6 years, 140 days, Antiochus began Hellenizing the Jews in 170 B.C., temples dedicated in December 164, after, these are my notes from years ago, I'll say it again, 170 B.C., and the temple is rededicated in December 164 after exactly 3 years of defilement. I guess, I wrote in the margin, the 2,300 days, 6 years and 4 months, refers to his entire effort to destroy the Jewish religion. And admittedly, years ago, last time I taught that, if you know, you're listening on the tape here, I really need to go back, trace everybody who's ever bought my class on Daniel, and like, take that class back. I think I guessed wrong the last time I taught that. And here's what I'd like for you to think about. I hadn't seen this idea, it didn't originate with me, but I found it in two different commentaries in my preparations this time, commentaries I didn't have last time. And so, you know, both suggested something, and that is built on Exodus chapter 29, verses 38 through 42. So please, I would heartily recommend that in verse 14 you write in the margin, Exodus 29, verses 38 through 42. Now I'm going to put most of those four verses up on, or five, I guess it is, up on the screen here. But, excuse me, some of it's repeated, so you know, I've pared it down a little bit. But in 29, verses 38 through 42, you have these words in verse 38. This is what you shall offer on the altar. 2 one-year-old lambs each day, continuously. Now, if you have a continuous sacrifice on the altar of lambs, a continuous sacrifice, could that be described as a regular sacrifice? Sure could, and it was. This is the establishment of the regular sacrifice. We are in Exodus, where God is giving Moses the information that will be developed at length in Leviticus, Numbers, repeated in Deuteronomy. They're still going to have the tabernacle for a long time, but that sacrifice got started way back in Moses' day in Exodus 29 in the wilderness. This is what you shall offer on the altar. 2 1-year-old lambs each day, continuously. But now 39 says, the one lamb you shall offer in the morning, and the other lamb you shall offer at twilight. It shall be a continual burnt offering throughout your generations at the doorway of the tent of meeting before the Lord, where I will meet with you to speak to you there. So now twice we have the word continual. We have a burnt offering that is in 38 of two lambs. But those two lambs' deaths and burnings, do they happen at the same time? No. There's one in the morning and there's one in the evening. So the continual sacrifice took place every day, but it also took place how many times each day? Twice a day. In the morning and again in the evening. Bill, go ahead. The 70 years of captivity will be long gone and over, and Daniel dead and buried before any of this prophecy is fulfilled. So they're different, altogether different, unrelated. Okay? Distant future, he's just told us. What Daniel's seeing now is well in the distance. But Daniel in 550 is only 14 years away from the end of the 70-year captivity. And so 14 years is not way out there. And we'll see by the end of the book. Daniel's going to die. He's going to see it. So appreciate that. Daniel's brought up a lot of things. And the 70 years is coming back in a big way. Next chapter. Next week. First verses. But it isn't here. Okay. Here we're talking about Medo-Persia and Greece. So let me show you something here. How long would the regular sacrifice cease? Well, it's 2300 evenings and mornings. If you count one sacrifice the first day in the morning, one sacrifice in the evening, and then the next day, 3, 4, third day, fifth sacrifice, sixth sacrifice, 2,300 evenings and mornings divided by 2 equals what? 1,150 days. Now, that's a rather venerable interpretation, as a matter of fact. It goes back an awful lot of centuries and all that. But I was unaware at that time. It had not crossed my mind to think that using evenings and mornings, and I've wrestled with it, and if you got something, you know, I'd love to hear it. I don't know why it starts with the evening and then the morning, why it didn't say mornings and evenings. I don't know if that's just a cultural thing with the Jews or what. Although it is true with the Jews, we'll learn later, time of Christ and all of that. When did they start their day? In the evening at 6 o'clock. So if you got this day going to end and we don't want it to fall over onto the Sabbath and Jesus hanging on the cross, then what do we have to do? We have to get him down before the, what would actually be the evening sacrifice, or the regular sacrifice. They would come together. So it looks to me like just that's the way they kept time. God used it the other way around in Genesis, you know, but it doesn't matter. 2,300 evenings and mornings divided by 2 is 1,150 days, as the Jews would more often keep their time. So I think that's what he's talking about. I think he's talking about 1,150 days. He's talking about 6 years and 4 months. Then half of that would be 3 years and 2 months. Now I want to read the note in my margin again, which I've derived from various commentaries, you know, and just the historical history. 6 years and 140 days, Antiochus began Hellenizing the Jews in 170 B.C., and the temple was rededicated in December of 164 after exactly 3 years of defilement. 3 years and 2 months is what this 1,150 days would be. And in the history, the books are saying that defilement was 3 years. Now, it's critically important, brethren, that we appreciate once again does the Bible need to be reconciled so that it matches archaeological decisions? Or should the archaeological decisions be reconciled to match God's Word? And how many times have you heard me say in all the Old Testament classes and New Testament as well, we think that the date was here. But are the archaeologists usually ever that specific? No. And if there's a variance between a biblical number and what an archaeologist thinks happened 4,000 years ago, which one are you going to take? I'm going to take the Scripture. So in the Scripture, I'm told I'm either looking for what would be 6 years and 4 months, or I'm looking for 3 years and 2 months. What I think we've found is that Antiochus Epiphanes did in fact defile the temple, did in fact bring that daily sacrifice to an end, and it would take the Maccabees 3 years, and I believe the more accurate is and 2 months later, they seized the temple back and cleansed it and resumed. In other words, they vindicated, they restored, and they cleansed it. So for me, really, it's just more than a little bit tempting to just say, well, Daniel's using days because God's telling him to. It's all about the evening and the morning sacrifice. And as a Jew, you would recognize that as happening twice a day, separated by many hours, and marking in the evening the start of a new day. And so we have then evenings and mornings, 1150 days. Now we'll come back to that in a minute. Right now, let's just read on into the interpretation that you have in verses 15 and following. Came about when I, Daniel, had seen the vision that I sought to understand it, and behold, standing before me was one who looked like a man. And I heard the voice of a man between the banks of the Euli. Now, again, this may well have been the canal that, you know, came across between the Tigris and Euphrates or some other canal that had been built or one of the rivers. Not sure. But I heard the voice of a man between the banks of that water, and he called out and said, Gabriel, give this man an understanding of the vision. Now, I'm going to deal with Gabriel here, but he's a bringer of good news. He appears a couple of times in Scripture. But we'll just pass on him, come back later. 17, so he came near to where I was standing, and when he came, I was frightened, fell on my face. But he said to me, Son of man, understand that the vision pertains to the time of the end. Now, while he was talking with me, I sank into a deep sleep with my face to the ground, and he touched me and made me stand upright. He said, behold, I'm going to let you know what will occur at the final period of the indignation, for it pertains to the appointed time of the end. So, in verses 15 through 19, I put my first line on the screen now. Under the interpretation, in 15 through 19, what are we told? The vision pertains to what? Twice we're told. The time of the end. What is the only thing that has ended in that time we've been discussing? The regular sacrifice. And then the holy people who got trampled, what are they going to do? They're going to get it back, vindicate it, restore it, and cleanse it. And so we've got 1150 days, or else we've got, you know, 6 years and 4 months, 2300 actual days. So we've just got to decide, what are we talking about here? But in 19 he said, behold, I'm going to let you know what will occur at the final period of the what? Indignation. It's the final period of the indignation. I think that God's people and God himself would be quite indignant at the transgression of the holy people, which is so bad that they must be punished, trampled for 2300 evenings and mornings. And when they are, that is when the sacrifice will come to an end. This end, this time of the end that comes up twice, is it the end of time? No, it's the time of the end. And the end of what? The end of the indignation, which lasts for how long? 2,300 evenings and mornings, either 3.2 or 6.4 years. So now then, it pertains to the time of the end of the indignation. In chapter 8, verse 20, the ram which you saw with the two horns represents the kings of Russia. Well, if you're a premillennialist, you know, you can see anything in Scripture, but we're not. What did the voice interpreting the dream say the ram represented? Medo-Persia. Is there anything else to think about? Was there a rising nation in Daniel's time during his captivity? That's Medo-Persia. Do we have their capital city just inside modern Iran? Look at all the dirt that grew over it. This we know what it is. And that's because we're told what it is. Then he says in verse 21, and the shaggy goat represents the kingdom of Greece, and the large horn that is between his eyes is the first king. Is there a history book in the history of man that does not know what the kingdom of Greece is? And unanimously all agree. That knows the difference between the Macedonian kingdom, Philip of Macedon being its king, and the Grecian kingdom, Alexander III, called the Great, who is Philip's son, but who then did what the Philip never did. Went out and just conquered everything he could lay his eyes on. Kingdom expanded unbelievably to the east, the north, and the south. Okay? It's Alexander. Is the first king of Greece. There isn't any question, unless you just don't want to believe what Daniel is saying, and a lot of people don't, because it is so specific. They say, well, Daniel didn't live before these events. He must be living after these events. He is a liar. He's already lived through this history. Now he's lying to you and telling you he lived before it, trying to make it look like, you know, there's this book that foretells the future. It's how desperate a lot of people get. Brethren, what does the ram represent? Medo-Persia. What does the goat represent? Greece. What does the big horn on the goat represent? The first king. Now we read verse 21. There is also in 21, the large horn that is between his eyes is the first king. I already read that, just didn't put it up. So 8:22. And the broken horn. Now the broken horn is the what number horn? The first horn. It gets broken. And then the four horns that arose in its place represent four kingdoms which will arise from this nation, although not with its power. So now we have an interpretation that's been given. And brethren, in verses 15 through 22, so far, how hard is this to figure out? Which is really not at all. The 2,300 evenings and mornings, you know, it's a puzzlement. And there's several answers to it. But that's before the interpretation. When we get to the interpretation of 15 through 22, is there any question about any of it in 15 through 22? No, it's a piece of cake. So here's what the cake represents. The goat had one horn. Who was that? Alexander. When it says one horn, you know, that's the mystical number that's representative symbolically of unity. I just made that up. It sounds good, doesn't it? What's the problem with it? No reason to believe that. Sounds good. But it's the first king of what? Greece. What does one mean? One. Now, four, of course, you know, is a symbolic number, and it's representative of... We'll make it whatever you want to be. Because just like people usually make out of 7 and 10 and 3, there will be no biblical justification for it. It's just we picked up what denominational people said. And we came to just believe that these certain numbers in biblical numerology have these ideas attached to them. So that when you see these numbers, then you know 7 means this and 10 means that. You multiply 7 times 10, any multiple of it is going to mean this. And then 6 is 1 less than 7. So since 7 means this, then 6 must mean that. Now if you triple 6, 6, 6, 6, that's 3 times the incompletion that the 7 meant completion. It all sounds great. What's our only problem with all of that? Not one verse in Scripture says anything the like. Now, brethren, sometimes numbers are symbolic. They can be figurative. I know that. But you'll have a reason to think so in the context. And until you find such a reason, what does one mean? One. In this case, what does the one represent? One came. What's his name? Alexander. Then 4 came up. Here are those men. They are Cassander, Seleucus, Ptolemy, and Lysimachus. These were the 4 generals who, out of 13, wanted his kingdom when he died so suddenly at the age of 33. There were, out of the 13, there were 5, you know, that were left standing, so 8 just immediately had no chance. There was one guy who lasted just a tiny little time, and then there were 4 guys that split up the kingdom. So here's my note for you in verse 7, if you will, or in the interpretation, if you like. Alexander III, who is the great, was born in 356 B.C., and he was superhuman, brethren. He just really was. He broke a horse that nobody else could break when he was 12 years old. At 16, he led troops into battle, and he was winning. This guy is serious stuff. He beat Thebes in 335. He became the sole ruler in 335. He beat the Persians up from 334 to 323, and he died, just coincidentally, at the age of 33. Apparently syphilis and homosexual. Alexander, though. If you ask me. But he did fly across the surface of the earth, didn't he? Feet never touched the ground, is what it seemed like. One big horn. Gone. And 4 guys fought for the kingdom. They are Lysimachus, you can spell it here, I'm getting it for you later. He got the country called Thrace, that portion of Greece called Thrace. Cassander got Macedonia, which was Alexander's daddy's country. Seleucus the First Nicator got Babylon, Syria, and Asia Minor. And Ptolemy the First Soter, S-O-T-E-R, got Egypt and Palestine. And thus began the great battles between the kings of the north, those are the Seleucids, and the kings of the south, which are the Ptolemies. Because immediately after Alexander died, you had that kingdom split 4 ways. All the history books say so. That's where we get the names. And then, after a while, 2 guys took over. By the time you get to chapter 11, you read about the kings of the north, the kings of the south. It goes on and on and on and on and on, all the way down into the Roman Empire. The kings of the north are the Seleucids. The kings of the south are the Ptolemies. Okay? So, it really is a piece of cake. But, we still got that little horn to figure out. Okay? So what about the little horn? This is where we'll bring our class to a conclusion here this evening. Last list for you. In Daniel 8, 23 through 26, we have this. In the latter period of their rule, whose rule? The 4. In the latter period of the 4 generals who took over Alexander's kingdom of Greece, when the transgressors have run their course, who were the transgressors earlier in this chapter? The transgressors earlier in this chapter were the ones that had the sanctuary and the regular sacrifice. They were called the host, and they get trampled because of their transgression. In the latter period of these 4, when the transgressors have run their course, so their iniquity is full, a king will arise, insolent, skilled in intrigue, and his power will be mighty, but not by his own power. He'll destroy to an extraordinary degree, and prosper and perform his will. He will destroy mighty men and the what? The holy people. Through his shrewdness, he will cause deceit to succeed by his influence. He will magnify himself in his heart. He will destroy many while they are at ease. He will even oppose the prince of peace, prince of princes, but he will be broken without human agency. The vision of the evenings and mornings, which has been told, is true. But keep the vision secret, for it pertains to many days in the future. Many days in the future, brethren, there will be a king who rises up out of those four, and he'll be in the latter period of their rule. And his name is Antiochus the Fourth, Epiphanes. And he is renowned in all history for his cruelty and for his extreme hatred of the Jews. And how he was determined to put an end to that religion. He came romping into town, and you all know the story. You've all heard it before. How did he defile the temple? He sacrificed a pig on the altar. What does that do to the temple? Shuts it down. Defiles it. What will it need? Well, it's going to need a vindication. It's going to need a cleansing is what it's going to need. It's going to need to be properly restored. But it wasn't. For how long? 3 years and 2 months is very close, the archaeologists think, to the length of time it took. How long did God say it would be? 3 years and 2 months. That's a regular sacrifice. 2,300 evenings and mornings. 2,300 evenings and mornings. If you count the evening and the morning 2,300 times, you come up with what? 1,150 days. 3 years, 2 months. Later period, insolent, skilled, destroyed the holy people. He's the guy that kicked off the whole Hasmonean revolt, which we call the Maccabean period. Opposing the prince of princes. Now that one's a little bit harder. I'm suspecting maybe it's the high priest is the idea. But brethren, though it is many days in the future, is it conceivable, is it possible, that in the latter days of Greece, which hasn't been around for a long time, that we can be talking about Jesus, or the end of the world, or the end of time? It's the time of the end of the indignation, because the transgressors are going to be punished by having their temple defiled. And they're going to then, you know, have to fight their way back, and 3 years later they do. What, by the way, is the feast that the Jews now celebrate that has to do with the rededication of that temple. They call it the Feast of Lights, but the one word you usually hear is Hanukkah. Okay? That's what that is. It goes all the way back to this prophecy, as a matter of fact, because it did say that after the regular sacrifice would stop for 2,300 evening and morning sacrifices, then it would be restored. And it was. Now, why don't you go back and look at 11. He removes the regular sacrifice, and he throws down the sanctuary. Brethren, the sanctuary only gets thrown down so many times in history. Okay? It gets thrown down by Babylon. It gets rebuilt again. It gets thrown down by Antiochus the Fourth. And it gets thrown down again when? Herod's going to build it up. The Romans are going to tear it back down. And then it's never going to be rebuilt again. Okay? So we've only got three choices. And it's limited to Greece. Who is the little horn? Antiochus the Fourth, Epiphanes. Now, I read commentary after commentary after commentary, Brendan, and it really got to where finally it was just frustrating and disappointing to me. How many times do you have to hear somebody say, since there is no way possible to get these 2,300 days to line up with anything in history, then they must be symbolic. What I just said is, all I just said is, I'm totally ignorant. I don't know how to match it with history. So I declare they must be symbolic. You need to go read these commentaries where they tell you what the 2,300 days represents, since they refuse to allow it to match anything in history. And I kid you not, I read stuff that sounded like the 2300 is a symbolic number that represents symbolic numbers. I kid you not. It was just amazing to read that stuff. Now, when a guy started talking with it, I can't think of any reason for it to be literal. Therefore, it cannot be literal. What did he do? Did he just declare omniscience? Infallibility? All he said was, I don't know how to do that. And you know why they didn't know how to do that? Because when they saw 2,300 evenings and mornings, they said that has to be 2,300 24-hour periods. We are not going to do what Exodus 29 suggests, divided by two, because there's two sacrifices in each day. And if you just simply do that, you get 1,150 days. Well, but it doesn't line up by 2 whole months, according to the archaeologists. Do I care to put the archaeologist over my Bible? I do not. Who's wrong? We've got a discrepancy here of 2 months. The archaeologists. How many times have they been wrong? Awful lot. How many times has your Bible been wrong? Never. So, whether you take 2300 or 1150, you can spend the rest of your life with your pencil and your calculator going, oh, 70 completion, 6 is 1, 7, and then 10, and we multiply. You ought to read those. They just go on and on. It doesn't make any sense. No, it doesn't. It really doesn't. So why are you promoting it? Why not promote this? The numbers mean what they say. They're not symbolic of something else. They represent the actual number of days that the transgressors suffered the indignation of their sanctuary being thrown down, the regular sacrifice ceased, in the only time frame available, which is during the Greek Empire, where we have to have a king who rises up out of the four from the one that is named as Greece. Are any of those numbers symbolic? They are literal, and they add up. Case closed. And have a good night. I'm going home to play with my grandkids.